Very good. So I am going to start in 2 seconds. Okay. Hey, everyone. Thanks for coming back to the... I'm going to start again. Hey, everyone. My name is Colin Fitzpatrick, and welcome back to the Web3 Leaders Podcast. Today, I'm really excited to have an amazing guy, Nick Rossa, who is the Metaverse Strategy Lead for Accenture. Obviously, one of the biggest consulting companies out there. So we're very, very privileged to have a man of this caliber on the podcast. Nick, you are very, very welcome.
Thank you so much, Colin. It's a pleasure being here. Thanks for having me.
So Nick is the author of a book called Understanding the Metaverse, A Business and Ethical Guide, which I have read, and it's a fantastic and engaging read. You should definitely go to Amazon and buy it. I have it on my Kindle. But he also has a couple of super interesting keynotes from various conferences and metaverse conferences around the world, which I would highly recommend you watch. There's one that's on his LinkedIn. Follow him, Nick Rossa, on LinkedIn. And that's why I reached out and I said, Nick, why don't you come on the podcast? Because he has a very unique and interesting insight on not only what the metaverse is and where it's going, but some of the business opportunities, some of the ethical guidelines, the future development, and kind of what we're going to talk about, especially today, is this hype cycle that we've sort of been through and why it's important to really understand the underlying importance of where it is, where it's going, and how long that's really going to take. So, Nick, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and where you've been and how you got to where you are today.
Sure. So, Nick Rossa, I'm Italian. Been living in London for the last 14 years, and I've been working in emerging technologies forever. I started my career as in journalism. I studied media and journalism because I wanted to be a professional journalist, and I've been writing about music and video games for 5 years on magazines in Italy, different magazines in Italy. But funny enough, I landed my first job on the other side of the barricade. I was taking care of the media and PR for a video game company, a video game publisher, Atari. At the time was called Infogram. Probably you remember it for those old video games, Alone in the Dark. And we were distributing also Unreal and Unreal 2 and Unreal Tournament. The video games from Sega were distributed by Infogram at the time. So I spent a couple of years there, and then I decided to cut my career. My office, my day 9-to-5 career to move towards following my passion that at the time is still, as you can see here, is music. I've been a music producer, a DJ. I had my radio show on a national radio network. It worked for a couple of years, 2.5 years. And then I got called from Yahoo because they were opening their new channels, new entertainment channels in Italy. I started working there, and then I got a call from after a couple of years, I got a call from Virgin Radio, where I reconnected also with one of my fellow colleagues at the radio, DJ Ringo, that was the art director, is still the art director of Virgin Radio Italy. I worked there for 3 years. We literally built everything from the ground up when it comes to the digital properties that they had. Then I got a call from Spotify in 2009, and that was, as you can imagine, irresistible for somebody like me that loves music and innovation. We launched the mobile app. I fell in love with mobile. I spent quite a lot of years doing a mobile transformation in 3 different agencies after Spotify, and then IBM, where I led the digital transformation team for Europe in media and entertainment. And then Accenture called me because they were in need of a specialist related to immersive technologies. And at the time was perfect because the Kickstarter had been launched and was successful for Oculus. The Oculus, the consumer product had been launched and was successful. And Meta was about to acquire Oculus at that time. And I decided to join Accenture to lead the extended reality team in Europe. And now I'm leading the metaverse strategy at Accenture. So as you can imagine, all of my passion collided together into the metaverse team. So entertainment, technologies, mobile, and innovation all together.
So that is super cool. And I did not know that about you. I did, and I was going to say it earlier, I saw some musical equipment in the background. I'm obviously not at home right now, but if I was and we were doing a Zoom, I have a DJ setup in my background. I've been a DJ since I was in my teens. I still have a very significant passion for, oh, what have you got?
I got a Pioneer XZ, yeah. An exact.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. I just have one of the little controllers, but I built myself a full setup when I've got the KRK rockets and stuff. Hugely passionate about music, electronic music. Don't DJ very much anymore, but still listen to it. But I love your unbelievable background, not only, you know, as a music producer, but then you work for Spotify and then, you know, all those things. So privileged to have you on. We're going to get some fantastic insights. And look, reason I started this podcast, I just love talking to people about this sort of stuff. And it turns out that other people do too. So when we have a few interesting people on a Zoom together talking about these revolutionary technologies and where it's going, but having someone with your level of experience and insights, I can't wait.
Thank you so much.
So maybe just tell us, number one, a little bit about your book and what it's about and what led you to write it in the first place.
So the book is called Understanding the Metaverse, A Business and Ethical Guide. And I had the privilege of creating this book with the support of Wiley Publishing that distributed the book globally. And I have some very great contributors that co-wrote 4 of the 9 chapters of the book. I have to mention them, Dr. Fadi Shaimi, Maria Mazzone, Bob Gerard, and Jamie Solomon, that helped me compiling some of the most important chapter of the book. It's a guide that is really approachable, down to earth. It's written in really plain English, is easy to understand, and that's why it's called Understanding the Metaverse. Has some very practical and actionable insights on how to apply technologies that are part of this infrastructure, continuously evolving infrastructure, which is this metaverse that we're building right now, gathering value right now for any companies in any sector in the world. It's also a warning sign, because I believe that it's important to approach the use of emerging technologies not in a blind and reactive way, as we've been doing in the last 300 years with all the innovation that's have been created, from fossil fuel to social networks, just regulating them when there are some problems that are happening in this world and when the impact on society is irreversible. But it's important eventually to create some boundaries to the utilization of some of the technologies that could be potentially dangerous for the status quo of our society and our democracies. And basically, this was the ethos behind the creation of the book. I also had the privilege of having the forewords of the book written by Professor Tom Furness, that, as many of you may know, is globally recognized as the godfather of virtual reality. He invented many of the systems that are used nowadays in modern AR and VR systems.
So let me ask you a real simple question for people who are not as knowledgeable. Give us your definition of the metaverse.
Sure. So the metaverse is an infrastructure, and is an infrastructure that is not here yet. It is similar to a moonshot, what has been declared by Kennedy in the 60s, that said that we want to go to the moon. We decided to build the metaverse, and the metaverse is going to be an infrastructure that will enable millions of people to connect in using immersive technologies, but also 2D screens, but interacting with the content in a three-dimensional way instead of a two-dimensional way as we do right now with normal web. And at the same time, being able to have a synchronous events and conversation with millions of other users around the world. They will be able to work, they will be able to entertain themselves, they will be able to meet friends and family in this virtual world, but also this infrastructure will allow the digital content to enter into a real world. So it will be a portal for us to get into the digital world, but also a portal for the digital content to enter the real world. Interestingly enough, also we're going to be able to bring our identity from one platform to the other. And note, I'm saying metaverse platforms and not metaverses, because the metaverse is one. Transact with global cryptocurrencies that will be widely available and used on the platform, on different platforms. Also, one thing is important to mention, and I believe that is particularly important for the title of your podcast. A lot of people, it's confusing the metaverse for Web3. The metaverse can be Web3, but can also not be Web3. Web3 is the definition of the decentralized internet that has been created by the co-founder of Ethereum in 2014 to define an internet that is completely working on decentralized technologies. There are companies and there are platforms right now that are operating in the metaverse business, so using technologies that are widely recognized as part of this infrastructure that we are creating right now, that is basically the evolution of the internet as we know it. Like, for example, Fortnite, or like, for example, Roblox, or like, for example, Meta Horizon, that are completely centralized, that are not using blockchain technologies. And probably they will not use blockchain technologies for a while. But let's not forget that there are other companies that, because of local regulation, or because of industry regulation, or for legislation, or for legacy systems, they're not going to be able to use blockchain system or blockchain technology anytime soon. So it's important to understand that in a infrastructure that will gather millions of users and thousands of platforms, there will be a coexistence between centralized technologies and decentralized technologies for quite a few time.
So let me dig out on this, because this is something I ask myself. And when people ask, I'm biased. I like to think that, you know, the metaverse does depend on Web3. And clearly the biggest metaverses right now are Roblox and Fortnite and things like that. But at the end of the day, primarily they're games. That's it. You know, they are games that are an entire world, and you can build and you can socialize and things like that. So what's your definition of, you know, where does Web3 sort of pivot on this?
Yeah.
Is it important that, you know, Web3 is the part of the metaverse, or is it not at all? If Web3 died tomorrow, is the metaverse still going to come? Or does it really provide an important portion of what the metaverse needs to become? Because that's kind of where I see it.
Sure. So I'm a very pragmatic person. And I see the use of technology where it's needed and when enables, and when it's used for the unique characteristics that it brings. Okay, so there are use cases that need decentralized technologies. There are use cases that take advantage of decentralized technologies, like smart contracts, digital identity, cryptocurrencies, you name it. And this is important. There are some use cases that without decentralized technologies couldn't exist. However, it's also important to understand that some of the platforms, the metaverse platforms, and not metaverses, because the metaverse is one, that are nowadays most successful, both from a consumer perspective, but also from an enterprise perspective. Think about Arthur or Microsoft Mesh. Think about the HoloLens ecosystem and so on. They're not decentralized. You mentioned Fortnite and Roblox. Those are making big bucks. They're not decentralized. Probably Apple is going to launch their own ecosystem, and I'm pretty sure that it's very unlikely that it's going to be decentralized. We need to be realist here. There are some companies that will never renounce to their corporate structure. They will never be a DAO. They will never empower the users with full control of the platform itself. But we also have to be very much aware that our players that are coming from nothing and having an incredible success overnight, see OpenAI disrupting mega giants that have been in the business for years. Like, for example, Google that lost billions in valuation just because OpenAI launched ChatGPT overnight. So let's understand that there are some, we are literally scratching the surface here. We are in an era of digital primitives for everything that comes with decentralized technologies. We are kind of in a skeuomorphic era. So we are kind of emulating the kind of use case that were possible with previous technologies and medium before. Think about smart contracts. Think about cryptocurrencies. Obviously, there are digital versions and decentralized version of assets and use cases that are available in an analog way. But we are waiting for those use cases that are hugely transformational, that take full advantage of all the different bits and pieces that compose this infrastructure that is the metaverse. The really, the truly transformational use cases with decentralized technologies, I think that will arrive probably in the next 3 to 5 years. We are literally scratching the surface right now. We are exploring. Yes. And those use cases that will be emerging, they call emergent use case because they emerge from this kind of waves that are created by the, this plethora of thousands of millions of use cases that are creating are created on the market. And they're emergent because they have a huge, massive success. And at that point, we're going to have the Ubers, the Tinders, we're going to have the Shazams and so on. But right now, we are literally exploring that where is the real value of those use cases. And there are some use cases that have really good value in decentralized technologies. The other day I was talking about real estate, contracts for real estate. Right now, for example, real estate companies are not making any money from secondhand house market and is an asset that appreciate with time. Imagine what it would mean to connect a house with a digital twin and connect all the documents that are related to the property and the sale of the house and the insurance of the house bills, the energy bills and the utility bills and so on, all connected to one single NFT. How easy would be and frictionless would be the transaction from one owner to another? This not only would create a turbo boosted economy in real estate that will not have to wait those 2, 3, 4 months for each transaction to happen. And if you purchase a house, you know how painful it is to buy a house. You know, it takes long and there are so many paper to compile and so on, but also will reduce the kind of overhead that is put on top of a purchase of a house from governments just because of bureaucracy. So it's there are some use cases that could be potentially truly transformational, both for industries and for consumers. The fact is that not many countries and not many institutions are ready to embrace all of this change, but there are some countries that started to look into it.
Well, what's interesting is about what you say there is the, you know, the resale and the royalties. And I love having these conversations, but the fact is that most people, it's just way above them to understand why people would pay vast sums of money for things that are digital and in their head might believe. But there's some other elements to think about here, which is that, you know, whether it's a house or a t-shirt or whatever, you know, you buy a pair of shoes in real life, they last you a year or two, and then you chuck them out. That doesn't happen with digital assets because they're going to live forever and you can't lose them and you could sell them. And that's really interesting. Now, some crazy stuff is happening with land in the metaverse. I think because of this, you know, massive upswing we saw in the price of metaverse land and then, you know, the resulting crash, there's a whole lot of people just going, oh, haha, I told you so. It was rubbish. Never existed. That was a bubble. You know, what do you say to those people?
To be honest with you, when I was talking about real estate, I was talking about real estate, not virtual real estate. So my conversation about the royalty split was about creating digital twin of physical assets. So I believe that there is still value in the real market right now, but I believe that this value can be amplified by the augmentation that is provided by the digital assets that are attached to the real assets. So creating, tokenizing real assets, that's where the real value is right now. When it comes to purchase of land and purchase of digital collectibles, I think that the problem right now resides in the fact that there's no much portability from one platform to the other.
Yeah.
When the portability will be there, eventually that could be a good investment, and eventually that could be a good purchase. Although it's very clear that there are some platforms that have a presence on those digital properties and have a piece of digital land in order to attract users and eyeball on top of their brand and their products. That's a real use case, and that's valuable. Buying digital land for speculation, I don't think that right now is probably the wisest investment to do, because obviously the infrastructure to support the kind of global economy that could be this fully fledged metaverse in 10 years from now is not there yet to support the market. So my conversation was purely about the tokenization of physical assets. So when it comes to the digital assets, I would say there is value in being part of a community. There is value in token-based digital, in value-based tokens and digital assets that provides you access to specific communities, to specific events that give you access to a specific club of people. But having a monkey just to have a monkey for swag, yes, it can be cool for somebody that wants to show the millions, and it's fine. But when it comes to real value, which is what we're looking for at Accenture, this is what I'm doing, the use cases that we're looking for are others at the moment.
I wrote about this a little while ago. Not that I would ever buy a several hundred thousand dollar Bored Ape or anything like that, but I've met and spoken to a lot of people who have those. And it's a very, very engaging and different conversation that someone who doesn't know anything about Web3 NFTs just can't understand.
Yeah.
But I had a couple of people respond to this post on LinkedIn going, I have an ape, or I have, you know, a crypto kitty or whatever it is. And for them, it has opened doors that they would never have been able to open.
But it's a club.
And the way I always, it's a club, but it's a little bit like, you know, maybe you have a Picasso and you want to, you know, then you're hanging out with all your art mates. And if you want to get into that circle and you don't have any high-end art, you're never going to get in. But, you know, from this guy's perspective, and I'm going to have him on the podcast, he said that it has earned him so much more money, way more than he's ever sort of paid for this. And other people, I met a guy in Miami at one of the conferences, and I said, what do you do? And he basically goes, I have a Bored Ape. And I'm like, is that it? And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, what? So you just sort of go around to conferences just because you got an ape? And he's like, yeah. And I was just like, okay. I was like, so did you buy this? He goes, no, I got it for free. He goes, one of my friends just said, come to this event and you were going to get one of these things. So he just got completely lucky. Now it's his entire identity, essentially, which is incredible. But what it does is it, you know, makes you part of this club that opens up other things. And, you know, again, I'm not saying I'd spend my hard earned money on it, but it's very, very interesting to think about what the people who are in that club get from it and exploit, etc.
But you know, Colin, this is an interesting conversation that's you know, goes back ages. I don't know if you remember in the 80s there were the goth, the punks, people that were identifying themselves with a tribe, right? So now we have the crypto punks, okay? So the kind of access that you get to those community unlocks opportunities and possibilities of business that right now are very valuable because the market is highly unregulated and there's a lot of speculation and a lot of people that are into it are highly engaged also in entrepreneurial activities. So this is kind of normal from a logical perspective. When it comes to the value attached to it, also you have to think that, for example, Bored Ape is backed by Adidas, and there are some benefits for the people that buy the Bored Ape, not just owning the Bored Ape itself because you have access to other people that have the Bored Ape, but for example, you can get backstage to concerts, you access to exclusive events and all this kind of stuff. And I believe that that kind of association to a club that provides exclusive access to specific kind of benefits, events, and services, that's where the value is, because everybody wants to feel special, right? So that's that, and purchases something that's it's exclusive and potentially can gain value with time. It's not a bad business. It's something that's it's a reality. And as you said, it's happening right now. There are people that are shifting completely their identity to a piece of digital collectible just because open doors that were unthinkable for them before.
Yeah. Let's talk about, I suppose, what's most important right now. And I wrote about this a little while ago. The metaverse is, I'm not going to try and guess how many years old, but for most people, it's only a couple of years old, because for most people, they only heard about this when Facebook renamed to Meta. I mean, I talk about the fact that I used to be talking about the metaverse several years before this. In the business that I'm in now, and people thought I had three heads, they just didn't understand it. Out comes Mark, renames it, and everyone goes, bang, okay, right, it's the future of the internet, we understand it now, great. All the hype into it, the coins were going bananas, and yeah, I think a couple of years went by, and just a few weeks ago was this New York Times article going, the metaverse is turning into the meh Tiverse, and saying, oh, you know, it's not going to be there and blah, blah, blah. And my article, which started off was, oh, you know, the metaverse is dead, pack it up, we're going home. Well, hang on, is it that simple? Because at the end of the day, these transformational technologies do not happen in 1 or 2 years. I've always called it the name we are giving right now for the future evolution of the internet. And there are thousands of amazing companies building incredible stuff that will only really come to eventuality many years into the future. I also think there's a significant technology hurdle that we had to get over. Tell us your thoughts.
Right. So, as I said before, the metaverse as an infrastructure, there are many layers to this. Defining the metaverse by its surface, which is the part that's the consumer sees, so the platforms that are available, Fortnite, Roblox, Decentraland, Sandbox, Nike Swoosh, or Microsoft Mesh, and so on, it's very superficial. There is a deep and thick number of layers that compose this infrastructure that is not ready yet for prime time. So many of those platforms have already a lot of functionalities, but their full vision of the metaverse, where all those platforms will be interconnected together, where we're going to be able to bring our identity from one platform to the other, transact with the cryptocurrencies and digital money. All of those use cases will be enabled when all the layers that compose this infrastructure will be completed. And as I said before, is a moonshot. And as Kennedy in the 60s says, we want to go to the moon. And in order to make it happen, in 10 years, they had to invent GPS and celestial navigation systems, lightweight composite material, microchips. And those components right now are literally at the base of everything that is around us, everything. From the material of our houses, to mobile phones, to the way that we travel with our car and so on. The kind of innovation that are going to be needed in order to enable the digital identity, the automatic moderation, the transaction, the high speed, the synchronous, hyperscaled networking of millions of users on the same platform, on the same infrastructure, the computing power that is needed for that, the broadcasting of the images to lightweight, inexpensive devices that will receive the images computed in the cloud, because obviously you cannot burn the people's faces with a massive processor and graphic card slapped to a pair of glasses. All of this will require a huge amount of innovation. And the companies that right now are operating in creating intellectual properties, technologies and inventions that will power and fuel this revolution that is going to be the metaverse are accumulating an invaluable technology and intellectual capital that in 10 years from now is going to pay back. So those companies that right now are derided by many saying, oh, the metaverse failed, the metaverse is the metaverse, are going to be the Amazon of the future. Amazon got losses for 9 years before being profitable, because nobody believed in the fact that they were going to be able to create a global supply chain of products and a global marketplace that is going to be powered by cloud technologies. Now, Amazon is one of the most valuable companies in the world. And the same thing is going to happen for many of the players that are going to enter the market because they're working on technologies that are associated with the metaverse. OpenAI as well. OpenAI is one of those companies. When Sam Altman created OpenAI in 2015, and he said, we want to work on artificial general intelligence, people were laughing. Now see what happened with ChatGPT-4. It's crazy. So we are living in a landscape that is valuing the stock price more than the strategy behind the business, the long-term vision and strategy. Let's not forget about it.
Absolutely.
The investors that are panicking because a company like Meta that announced that they were pivoting into metaverse technologies in October 2021 and in the first quarter of 2023 were not turning over some big profits. It's obvious that the investors are panicking and they're asking to the board of directors to make some changes to the business. But let's not forget that, as we said before, this is a moonshot. This is going to require some time. We're building an infrastructure here. We're not just building a platform. We are building a full ecosystem that has to be interconnected. We need standards. We need regulations. We need transformational use cases and so on. The fact that Meta announced that they were pivoting towards the metaverse doesn't mean that they were not doing business as usual. Facebook was still online, Instagram was still online, WhatsApp is still online, and so on. They said that they were going to invest a huge amount of money and capital in research and development of innovative technologies that probably in 10 years from now will make them become the next Amazon.
So let me ask you a question, because you said something really important there. You talked about how OpenAI released a product and it just went, you know, kaboom, million users in 5 days. I don't know, approximately 100 now, several months later. A phrase you hear a lot in my industry is projects going out there to bring on the next 10 million, the next 100 million, the next billion people into the world of Web3, into the metaverse. But guess what? ChatGPT didn't need to do anything special to bring those people on. They just created an amazing product that everybody wanted to use straight away, that used absolutely no user manual, no instructions. You just have a box, you talk to it, and it talks back to you. We kind of still are waiting for this, and I hate to say it, but, you know, iPhone moment of the metaverse. But there's significant, as I said, technical hurdles, cultural development and hurdles that need to kind of happen. How do you see it planning out? I mean, it's not a cliff. It's a ladder. What do you see, or what do you think needs to happen before it becomes more mainstream? And how do you see it playing out?
We are in the Symbian Nokia communicator era of the metaverse.
Absolutely.
Right now. We have a glimpse of the potential use cases. We don't have a clue of the truly transformational disruptive use cases that will arrive in a few years from now. We don't have a clue about the potential threats that this kind of technology can have on our society right now. I mean, think about impersonation through deepfakes, hyper-realistic avatars, and so on. Meta has their codec avatars, and I'm pretty sure that probably they're reluctant to release it, because obviously this is a problem when it comes to digital identity. So it's important to understand here that there are some steps that need to happen in order, first of all, to make this the usability right. Let's not forget that this iPhone moment, the iPhone moment happens when technology, business models, and ergonomics come together. You need to have the perfect usability. You need to have an ecosystem of services and a business model that works. And you need to have the technology that supports all of this. Without these three components, the iPhone moment is not going to arrive, right? So when it comes to the business models, we have more or less an idea on how all of this is going to work. We want a global economy. We want interoperability between the platforms. But we haven't solved a problem yet, which is basically taxations between the platforms when you bring goods from one platform to the other. And you're laughing, but it's true. In the real world, if you buy something in one country and you bring it to another country, you purchase it from another country, you bring it to another country, you have to pay taxes.
Yeah.
Why? Because there are some countries that sell some items at a lower price compared to other countries. And there are some services that obviously need to be paid on that platform or in that country that's derived from a percentage of the cuts of the sales of that specific item. So if I buy a digital Lamborghini on the central land that cost me $0.50 and I want to bring it to Fortnite where it costs $1, obviously Fortnite wants to cut. So all of these kind of mechanics needs to be worked out. So the business model is kind of there, but there are some problems and there are some there are some standards that need to be agreed upon across all of the platforms. When it comes to the technology, I believe that when it comes to the technology, we are probably 50% there. 50-60% there. The problem with the technology is that right now, for example, waveguide visualization when it comes to augmented reality has its limitation when it comes to field of view and resolution and refresh rate. So we need a new kind of technology in order to provide images directly on the eyeballs of people in augmented reality. Virtual reality situation is a little bit better, and that's why I suppose that probably the upcoming headsets that everybody are talking about, and I don't even want to mention that name right now, but we all know that that's something that is happening and is brewing and probably is going to be launched in June. Probably that's going to be a very important moment in this industry. And at the same time, we have gaming companies like, for example, Valve, that's literally 2 days ago openly declared that they're working on their standalone headsets. And after the launch of the Steam Deck, it was extremely successful. I highly doubt that they're going to abort the launch of a standalone headset. But when it comes to usability, we are still light years behind. There are very few companies that are experimenting with hand gestures. The hand gestures on the Oculus Quest, the Meta Quest 2 right now and the Meta Quest Pro is good, but it's not perfect. And we don't have a general interface that is universal on how to use those natural commands. At the same time, we are literally dipping our toe when it comes to natural language processing with larger language models. So being able to interact with digital agents that reply programmatically to us, not through a script, is the future of interactivity with digital agents in those platforms. But right now it's very asynchronous. Imagine you talking, a text-to-speech agent identifying your speech, transforming it into text, pushing it into a large language model like ChatGPT. ChatGPT writes the response, and then this has to be compiled into a realistic audio file of some sort and then talk back to you. It's probably 2, 3, even 4 seconds of latency, and this is unacceptable right now. So all of those things need to change. We have an idea where we want to go, but we are not there yet. The snappy interface of the scrolling iPhone is not here yet, right? So we need some time, but we'll get there because we're working on
So you mentioned the company that you don't want to mention, and that's fine. I won't mention them either, but I will say that I refer to them all the time because if anyone's going to do it, you know, I think they have a good chance. Now, I've always said that right now, you know, wearing a VR headset is fine for a few minutes and it's fun and it's engaging, but it's not sticky and you certainly don't want to do it all day long. Correct. I do have a friend who told me, I got rid of my monitor, I put on my headset and I've got three giant monitors and I work that way. And I thought, brilliant, I'm going to try this out. And I did, but I'm definitely not going to do it very much. I mean, you know, I have this, I have a three-year-old son. And I kind of, I put the Meta Quest 2 on him. And his first thing was, Daddy, where are my arms? You know, which I thought was absolutely hilarious. But he got used to it real fast. And then he's playing with it. And I think that's absolutely crazy. But just as you said, the technology has to advance. We need a pair of glasses, just like a normal one that you put on and it beams into your eyeball. And then you've got proper augmented reality. And then think of the applications of what can be possible when we do that. A contact lens that goes into your eye and you can close your eyes and have a full immersive movie experience. But we're really, really far from that. And I think that we have a great opportunity to build really cool stuff, to conceptualize the, what's the Tom Cruise movie where he's doing all this stuff with his hands?
Minority Report.
That's the Minority Report effect. It's gonna go there. I saw, you know, Apple did come out with a new patent and it's, you know, moving your thumb like that. The industry needs to agree on a standard so that, you know, when you put on one headset, you take off and you put on another one, that you don't have to learn an entire new, you know, selection of gestures. We kind of need to figure out how it's going to go. But even going back to the early iPhone and early Android phones, it was different and it took a while until we figured out what the best way was. We've got a hell of a journey ahead.
Very real.
Yeah.
But we are in, I mean, we are not even there yet, interestingly enough. If you remember the first iPhones when they have been launched, then I was there and I worked a lot in mobile. I launched more than 60 mobile applications in my career. So when the first apps came out, they were no different from normal desktop, miniaturized desktop websites. With very little touch optimized interface. Then the burger menu started to actually the bar at the bottom of the application started to appear, if you remember, the one that you would tap at the bottom. And then we discovered that maybe it's better just to have the full screen and then the burger menu on the side. It's a better interface to get all the functionalities. So all of those things require time. And required, and interestingly enough, the user experience goes hand in hand with the technology. You need to have a technology that is able to support specific user experience. And sometimes the research that experience designers are doing, and I can tell because I've been an experienced designer myself in one of my roles when I was at IBM, I was doing quite a lot of experience design in my digital transformation role, experience design qualitative research. The kind of insights that you get from that experience design research drive the research in the technology field so that scientists that are experimenting with the technologies start creating technology that are able to support that specific kind of user experience that is needed by the products. So I think that the kind of product that company is going to launch is going to be non-dissimilar from what happened with the DK1 Oculus. We are assisting to the launch of a product that is going to create an ecosystem of application that will support a larger launch of what is going to be probably the flagship product of that is going to be an augmented reality pair of glasses. So the VR product that supports mixed reality that we're seeing right now is being launched in order to enable those developers to create ecosystem of applications in the App Store, then that will work out of the box with this this product that is going to be launched in the future, probably 2-3 years from now. And this is, I mean, this is no secret. Everybody knows about this kind of strategy. And there are some rumors that say Apple, now we can name it, openly announcing some of the board meetings that the product that they're going to launch is not going to fly from the shelf as the first Apple Watch did.
They're creating
a market, and they're creating the ecosystem of services and apps for that specific market in order to create.
And it's going to be $3,000 apparently at the beginning. So certainly won't be just flying off the shelf. It has to be
because think about it. Let's talk frankly. The kind of graphics and user experience that you have from standalone devices nowadays is usually disappointing. The devices that you connect to a PC, those ones provide a good experience. Half-Life Alyx, Google Earth, truly mesmerizing VR experiences, immersive experiences. The problem is the computational power. The computational power that you get from Meta Quest 2 or a self-contained Vive Focus 3 obviously is connected to the processing power of a Snapdragon 8, XR2, yes, which is basically comparable to a high-end Android device. We're talking about mobile processors. The kind of price tag for the new device is going to be launched by Apple is so hefty because apparently the architecture used is going to be an M2 Pro, which is the same kind of processor that is present right now on the MacBook Pros, that has a really good GPU, is able to run AAA games, and it provides a huge quality when it comes to graphics. Let's not forget about the fact that the usability and the willingness of consumers to use those kind of device depends by the kind of experience that they're going to have. If the graphics is blurry, if it's disappointing, if it's blocky, if it's not jaw-dropping, they're not going to use it. But if it's something that is highly engaging, photorealistic, and it's rumored that one of the killer use cases is going to be photorealistic avatars for telepresence. Apparently, this is going to be one of the killer use cases, which makes also sense because they have those LiDARs on every iPhone, and every person with an iPhone can make a scan of their face and create a digital avatar directly in the Apple ecosystem. And they have really good systems to provide digital identity checks for those avatars. So it makes sense, right? So it all depends by the kind of computational power. Then the computational power cannot stay on the device forever. It has to be moved to the cloud. And this is one of the big hurdles that need to be solved by the infrastructure.
But didn't Google already try this with their streaming gaming service that failed?
Yeah. It was the best technology available on the market.
But it's just not there yet. But we need to get there.
Because you can't have
an M2 processor in a pair of glasses.
But it's also a thermal dissipation problem.
Yeah.
The M2 processor is highly efficient when it comes to thermal dissipation. But the more we go towards photorealistic graphics, ray tracing, and so on, the more we're going to need to move the computation from the device itself to the cloud, from a cost perspective and from a usability perspective and for a safety perspective. You don't want to melt people's faces right? You know, a processor.
Well, remember the old laptops, and they were burning people's legs, and they had to start calling them notebooks because they had such a thermal issue there. I mean, we're going through those same exact things. And will it move to pixel streaming, where all of the sort of processing is done in the cloud, just chucks down is what you need to see and nothing more?
There are multiple technologies. There's pixel streaming. There's geometry streaming. There's a beautiful startup that is called Sense of Space that is run by a friend, Victor Paradino. They're doing is to computing in the cloud the geometry that is then rendered to the device. So the kind of stuff that they're pushing is way less than the full 4K image, stereoscopic image that some of the pixel streaming services are doing. But they're doing it in a very clever way. They're doing reducing the level of details. They're reducing the polygons that are occluded with Z buffering. They're doing some really, really cool stuff with their technology. And I believe that there are two different kind of approach. You know, there's NVIDIA that has their XR Cloud platform. They have the GeForce Now platform that is actually right now that Stadia is off the game, is the best game streaming platform in the world. The problem is always one. Stadia died because had no content. There were no games. AAA games were coming out. GeForce Now is an experiment because basically they are testing the technology that they're now using also on Omniverse and their pixel streaming services for VR, Cloud XR. But at the same time, right now, many of the AAA games that are on those that are available on Steam, they're not available on GeForce Now. So it's all about the content. I think that's across all the companies that right now are operating in the metaverse, it doesn't matter if you use the best technology.
I've lost my guest. Yeah, he's not there.
I can hear you.
Look.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Hello?
I don't know if it's me or if it's him.
Hello? I can hear you. Hello? Hello?
Hey, Nick, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Yes. Sorry about that. My internet died. I don't know what happened.
But I could hear you. You said I lost my guest and I could hear you.
I thought it was you, but it turned out to be me. It seems to be still recording on this side. So I think we can probably kick off. The last thing I heard you talked about, and I can edit this out later, talked about Stadia died because it had no AAA games. When I was saying, I can't hear you, what were you saying before that?
I was talking about the content.
Okay. Continue from somewhere along the line and I'll edit it out.
So at the end of the day, I believe that the winner of all the companies that are going to be operating in the metaverse business will come from the content and the services. Not always the best technology prevails, and not always the company that has the best hardware wins. Let's not forget what happened between VHS and Betamax. It's all about content, the content and the services. Those ones are going to be super important for this battle that is happening right now.
Okay, very interesting. So tell us a little bit about what you talk about in your book around ethics, regulatory pressures and changes. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So I'm a big fan of McLuhan. Medium is the message, right? The medium is the message. And as you can imagine, mobile phones are communication devices, can be photo cameras, can be a lot of other things. They can be MP3 players, but they're fundamentally communication devices. And they change the way that we communicate with our friends, family, people, loved ones, colleagues, the way that we work, and so on. So a communication device change our concept of communicating with the people that we know, that we love, and that we work with. When it comes to metaverse, we are talking about a reality device, augmented and virtual reality, right? And we are talking about ownership and identity. So all of those concepts and artificial intelligence as well. So if you think about that, it's pretty clear that those technologies are going to change the way that we conceive reality. They were going to blur the lines between what is real and what is not real. They're going to blur the line of what is human and what is digital. They're going to blur the line of physical ownership and digital ownership. They're going to blur the line between physical currency, fiat currency, and digital currency. So there's not going to be distinction between those things. And this is wonderful, but this is also pretty scary because it can be weaponized. I don't know if it happens to you sometimes to think about something that you want to buy. You think about it. You don't write it down. You don't tell it to anybody. And then after a few scrolls on your Instagram, you see an ad with the product that you were thinking about. Okay. This is not science fiction. This is not precogs. This is not Minority Report. This is an algorithm that is able to predict our behavior and is embedded in many platforms, in Instagram, in Amazon, and so on. And this is normal because this comes from the digital fingerprint that many of those digital companies have right now about us. When it comes though to the metaverse, one thing is to have an Instagram feed that shows you an image of something that you were thinking to buy. And obviously it's easier. You click, you buy. Another thing is to have somebody that's has data about the way that you move, your hands, your eyes, your pupil dilation, the color of your skin, the kind of blushing that you have based on what makes your heart skip a beat or makes your heart beat harder and faster. All of those data, biometric data, emotional data, the way you speak, the things you say, the concept that you express while you're talking, all of those data can be fed into algorithm that can be powered by large language models that are trained and instructed to sell you a new house, a new car, or a new political view. And this is highly dangerous.
Yeah.
This is dangerous and must be regulated because right now, you could find your next pal that is on a platform that acts like you've been knowing this person forever. He is your perfect pal, knows all the movies that you love, and knows is supporting the same football team that you love, and is funny and witty and smart and wonderful to be with, and is a great co-op player in multiplayer games and so on, and then starts talking to you about, you know, bad things or changing your political views and stuff like that, and in some way can change your mind on some fundamental values and concepts that drive your life and your values, and potentially undermining our society and our democracy. This is something that we need to keep in mind. There are some data that need to be regulated. There are some things that need to be regulated in terms of usage of digital content into the real world. Let's say, for example, in the future, there will be an augmented reality device that will able to provide photorealistic graphics. Whenever I walk into a room, if I see a can of Pepsi on a table, how am I going to know? And I'm thirsty. And I'm going to see that Pepsi on a table. How am I going to know that that Pepsi is not product placement?
Yeah.
So we need to regulate this kind of stuff. We need to know if we are the person that we are talking to is real or is a chatbot. We need to know that biometric data and emotional data and health data are not used for advertising purposes. they're only used for medical purposes. All of those kind of things need to be regulated right now, not by the platforms, but by the governments.
So let me ask you this question, because as we record today, just yesterday, Elon Musk came out and said he's releasing Truth GTP, and he bought 50,000 GPUs to do that. Now, we've already seen, and I think everyone's seen these, you know, pictures and memes of, tell me a joke about a man, it tells a joke. Tell me about a joke about a woman, no, it's not appropriate, okay? So tell me about a joke about this religion, and it does. Tell me about a joke about that religion, no, it's not appropriate. So, you know, there are biases in there. But what's going to happen if/when Elon brings out a more unfiltered and unrestricted AI? Because there's, let's face it, there's a very thin line between free speech and hate speech. And who decides that? Who decides what truth is? I mean, we have alternative facts, you know, all these sort of things.
Yeah.
One person's version of the truth is very different from another. So how do you even regulate this when, A, it's moving so fast, I can't keep up to date and I do nothing but read about it all day and night. And number two, our government is notoriously, A, slow at regulating, and B, they're too old to understand this stuff.
Look, I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty details of politics, and I don't think that this is the right forum to discuss about this kind of stuff. What I do believe is that there is a problem of misinformation nowadays, and there is a problem that's this problem is going to get worse with the automation of media content creation that is provided by AI agents. So, as I was saying before, it's easy to weaponize information when you have such a fantastic tool for media creation that doesn't require any line of code, that doesn't require any artistic skill, doesn't require any studio to shoot or to dub audio or video and so on. You just have to type something and video spit out from the machine and text is spit out from the machine and so on. You can create thousands of bot soldiers that are spreading your verb around the internet. What is needed right now is, first of all, keep an eye on your source where you get yourself informed. Get information from reputable sources, from companies that are checking facts. You know, there's no such thing as alternative facts or alternate reality. There's the reality.
Of course.
A fact is a fact. Fact-checking is the principle of journalism, and I studied journalism, right? And nowadays, warping reality for political purposes is, it's something that happens every day. And I'm not saying that it's happening more from one side or the other. I mean, everybody in different kind of level of degrees from in any governments, more sooner or later, ends up lying, right? So, we're not living in a perfect world, unfortunately. What I'm saying is that we have to keep our eyes peeled, because if there are some safeguards to those AI systems, just because it's easy to weaponize those AI systems. If you remove those safeguards just because you want to prove a point that I want to allow free speech to everybody and everybody can do and say whatever they want with those tools, then becomes dangerous. And this could be a problem. I understand that this earns a lot of likes to Elon Musk and elevates him to a paladin of free speech with a certain portion of the population that very likely voted for Donald Trump in 2016. Sure. But from my point of view, we need to be smarter than that. And we need to think not to next week, but to the next 50 years on how we're designing and building the systems to make the world better for the future generation, and not just better for the next 12 months on Twitter in order to boost popularity of the platform. So it's a very deep conversation, a long conversation. Now, I don't want to bore your listeners with this, but I believe that we can be better than this. You know, we've been using technology in a blind way, as I said, for the last 300 years, probably even more, without thinking about the potential consequences that those technologies could have on the society. And what we have global warming, we have mass shooting at schools, and we have weaponization of social networks from foreign governments to change the status quo in the election in different countries, including UK with Brexit. And it happened to me firsthand. So we can be better than that. We can be more proactive and less reactive to these kind of problems.
So I agree. Let's not go down the political and the negative wormhole, but let's try and think about the positives. With the incredible, you know, insights and how deep you are, what are some of the really amazing positives that are kind of come out of the development of, you know, what we're calling the metaverse over the next number of years?
The possibility of living 1,000 lives. It's interesting because when I think about the end game of the metaverse, there's one image that is very clear in my mind, that for people that lived the 90s as a teenager like me will remember very clearly, which is the Star Trek Next Generation holodeck. And that's the dream, you know, being able to live in ancient Rome or in the future, or live a firsthand Star Wars experience, meet with friends and family whenever you want, and wherever you are, close any kind of distance between you and your loved ones, being able to assist to any concert, any experience around the world. It doesn't matter where you are, you can be wherever you want. So, all of those things are amazing use cases for entertainment, for learning, for productivity, for social life, socialization. There will be new form of art. There will be new form of culture that is going to be created by those technologies. The possibilities are endless. As I said, it's a reality machine. So we're going to create realities, and we are on the verge of getting godlike powers. We are able to provide intelligence to machines, and we are able to create our own worlds and realities. The question is, are we going to be wise enough to use them in the right way, or are we going to abuse them, being connected day in and day out to those machines? I don't know if you read Brave New World, where people are so dependent by the endorphins that are created by the machines, that they would never want to be disconnected by the machines.
Yeah.
So these are wonderful things. We need to design our society and the regulations in order to make them happen in the most positive way possible. And right now there are companies that are taking huge advantage from these kind of technologies. With big rewards. We have companies like, for example, Accenture. We are onboarded 200,000 people since the inception of the pandemic using metaverse platforms. We are using it for learning and education. Now we're using it for productivity internally. We're deploying Microsoft Mesh to the whole company. So we are having meetings in virtual boardrooms right now. And it works really well, especially with a Quest Pro. All of those things have a huge impact for companies, but will have a huge impact also for the society in the future.
That's super cool. We don't have a lot of time left, so I'm just going to ask you this final one, which is, you know, I have a friend of mine who has a very, very small consultancy, and he told me that ChatGPT has enabled him to really up his game by competing with the big guys, probably not as big as you, but something like that. Because ultimately, what has AI done? It's democratizing content and intelligence in a way. How is that going to affect a company like Accenture, who is built upon this decades old of experience, of content, of expertise. Yeah. And now I can go in and have a conversation with GPT. And I do. I have a business kicking off. I'm getting it to, you know, explain to me how everything works that I don't know. Give me guidance on how I'm putting together strategy documents, marketing, things like that. And all of a sudden, it's leveled the playing field. Is this something that Accenture is afraid of? Are they just going to utilize it more? Is it going to take business? Where is this going?
Okay. First of all, we are not afraid of ChatGPT. We believe that ChatGPT is an incredible tool to augment the human capabilities. As you know, we are very much good friends of Microsoft. We even created a consulting firm with Microsoft, which is called Avanade. Sure. It is a partnership between Accenture and Microsoft. So we work very closely with Microsoft. And as you know, Microsoft owns a good chunk of OpenAI. So we see those tools as an augmentation of everything that we do. So your friend with a small consulting firm now can compete with the big guys. Imagine what the big guys could do with this kind of tools. So it's all about scales. I mean, also let's not forget that ChatGPT is an approximation, is like a JPEG of an image. There was a beautiful article that I think it was on The Atlantic that was talking about large language models, like a compression method for knowledge. Compressing the knowledge is great if you don't have a lot of time to study. It's great if you want to be short. Maybe it's not that great when the granularity counts. So what ChatGPT does and does very well is getting a lot of information, compressing them together and give them to you, right? But is as good as you are in inputting the prompt. So there are two things here that humans will, at least right now, are able to do better than ChatGPT. First of all, is holistically understanding the needs of other people and be extremely detailed in the way that we answer to those needs and those people. And right now, obviously, those large language models are allowing a lot of companies around the world to do amazing things. And I believe, and also we believe, that this is going to be the future and we're going to be able to achieve fantastic stuff and our productivity is going to skyrocket right now. But things are I think that the smart companies are not going to fire employees because of AI. Smart companies, what are going to do, are going to train employees on how to use AI to expand their business.
Absolutely. I mean, I have been thinking an awful lot over the last number of months about the fact that AI is a platform and many, many massive and highly profitable businesses are going to be built on top of this and what they're going to be and where it's going to be and kind of think of everything. But it's not just that. You know, you don't have to invent the next, iPhone. The ancillary businesses that will be around that to support. And, you know, I'm kind of like, well, maybe create a AI consultancy company or something like that. But then again, like you said, every consultancy company out there is just sort of going pivoting like this and going straight into AI because every business, be it absolutely huge or, just a couple of people, are going to have to figure out how to utilize this and how to bake it into what they do. Because if they don't, they're going to get left behind because most of their competitors will, and they're going to be successful.
Also, let's not forget, there's a correction that I want to make to what you just said. AI is not a platform, it's a technology. And the technology can provide a fantastic output based on the data set it's trained on. Now, if you have a generic data set like OpenAI for ChatGPT, you have some good results across generic needs, But when it comes to specific needs, you need to have specific data sets to train your model on. And I believe that the ownership and the IP of those data sets is going to make the difference in the future for all the AI companies. And that's why I'm saying and I'm stating that I'm not afraid of AI when it comes to consulting or other specific kind of business, because the smart business are not going to be like Blockbuster, but are going to be more like Netflix for the future, right? So they're not going to say, no, thank you. Not going to laugh to the internet deployment of movies and videos, but are going to start to embrace those kind of technologies and pivot their company towards those technologies. So it's a matter of how you train the data set at the end of the day. And it's going to be how easy it's going to be for the user to enter the prompt in order to get a result, and how good the data set are going to be in order to spit out the right content. Those are going to be the differentiator for AI companies to AI-based and built companies to thrive and to have success in the future.
Nick Rossa, that was fascinating. Absolutely love it. Thank you so much. I could talk all day and night on this, and I definitely want to have you back to maybe expand on a few of the different areas, and certainly as more happens. Please follow Nick on LinkedIn. Go buy his book. It's a fascinating read. And thanks so much. It was an engaging conversation, and I can't wait to have it do it again.
It's been a pleasure, Colin. Thank you so much for having me, and thanks everybody for listening.